So with Parshas Va'era, the process of Yetzias Mitzrayim begins in earnest, and I'd like to take a look at, shall we call it, the mission statement of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is expressed in Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. So at the very beginning, of course, we have the famous four expressions of Geula and other matters. And then in Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aharon. Hashem speaks to Moshe and to Aaron. Vayitzaveim el b'nei Yisrael. He commands them to b'nei Yisrael. Ve'el Paro Melech Mitzrayim, and to Paro, king of Egypt, Lehotzi es b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim, to take b'nei Yisrael out of Egypt. And as we can appreciate, and Rashi himself addresses this or responds to this, the pasuk on a simple level sounds like Hashem is commanding Moshe to two groups, to the Jewish people and to Paro. And what is the goal? To take B'nai Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. As we can appreciate, of those two groups, there's only one of them that can actually take them out of Mitzrayim, and that is Paro, meaning lead them out or let them go. The role of B'nai Yisrael is not to take themselves out. Perhaps we could say to be amenable to leaving. But it's very interesting the way the pasuk is phrased, that both to the Jewish people and to Paro, to take the B'nai Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. What exactly are we to make of this? And it's a very interesting approach, quite unusual, to this pasuk, which is found in the Meshech Chochma. And Meshech Chochma says, if you wish to get a broader context as to what does it mean to command B'nai Yisrael to take B'nai Yisrael out of Mitzrayim? It's not up to them. They can leave, but they can't do more than that. They can agree to leave. The answer, says Meshech Chochma, is in the psukim that follow. For what is it that we find after Yud Gimel? From Yud Dalet and onwards, the next a dozen or so psukim are the yichus of the first three tribes. Eile Roshe Beis Avosam, we have first Reuven, and then Shimon, and then Levi. And it stops at Levi. So it's a very interesting partial lineage of the tribes. We assume it stops at Levi because it's all leading up to Moshe and Aharon. But there is something about these three tribes. We know it already about one of them. There's a well-known idea that the tribe of Levi was not really or fully involved in the persecution and the subjugation and the backbreaking labor. Somehow they had it easier. It's explained because they were learning Torah that was recognized from the beginning, or involved in spiritual pursuits. That's a well-known idea about Levi. But on a broader level, the Medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah says a similar thing about all of the first three tribes. Reuven, Shimon, and Levi nohagu sarara b'Mitzrayim. They enjoyed a certain privileged status in Egypt. They were still servants, and they weren't there. They weren't their own free to do as they want in every respect, obviously. But they had a relatively more privileged status. So says Bamidbar Rabbah. It's interesting, just parenthetically, before we get back to our pasuk, Meshech Chochma gives us further insight into this idea, taking us backwards and then forwards. When we say backwards, if we're looking to get some type of understanding of the background, why would it be that these first three tribes would have an easier time, relatively, of the exile in Egypt than the others? Where does it come from? Meshech Chochma suggests, and this will give us, again, further insight into the brachas of Yaakov. Just before Yaakov passes away, he gives brachas to, to all of his sons. And we understand that the import and the impact of those brachas will not be felt for perhaps for generations. This tribe will be like this, and this tribe will be like this. Zevulun will be on the coast. When? Not anytime soon. So the practical effect of these brachos won't be for a while. But that's not true. The practical effect was much more immediate because it was a knowledge of their future and their destiny and the good things that would come ultimately is what gave them strength to withstand the difficulties of Mitzrayim. The chizuk, the encouragement, was of immediate impact. That's a very interesting way of looking at the brachos. We see the brachos, they're almost like they're put in abeyance until they're relevant. No, they made a difference throughout. Whenever things got difficult, Zevulun remembers. Zevulun Yechov Yamim. Asher Me'asher Shmina Lachmo, and so on and so forth. But once we appreciate that much of the ability to withstand the difficulties of the exile came from the brachos that were given to the tribes, go back to the brachos given to the first three, says Meshech Chochma. They were not as encouraging as the others. They took the form of criticism, of critique, and there are, of course, reasons for this. But Reuven was told what he lost and why. Shimon and Levi were upbraided for their anger. And again, it's important for a person to be appraised of their qualities, to be encouraged to channel them in a good way. But certainly the overt tone of those first three blessings was not as positive and not as encouraging as the others. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, the chizuk effect of the brachos was less. For these first three tribes, they would not have been able to withstand as much of the persecution as the others because they had less of a positive bracha to buoy them and to keep them going. And that is why they had something of an easier experience. Nahagu Sraro b'Mitzrayim. It's an amazing line to be drawn all the way back from Yaakov's brachas forward into their experiences in Mitzrayim, to see not only how the brachas impacted on Mitzrayim generally, but even specifically down to the tribe, the nature of the brachas they received. But the effects, having looked back to the brachos, let us look forward, says Meshech Chochma, to the inheritance in the land of Israel. Because we know that the inheriting the land of Israel was also as a result of going through the subjugation in Mitzrayim. That was the process, and that's what happened at the end. Vehivesiosam, in order to bring them to the land. But that also is itemized. Because once again, not only is it true generally that those who went through the persecution in Mitzrayim received a portion in the land of Israel, but the extent to which they went through that persecution affected the extent or the nature of the inheritance that they received in the land. What does this mean? There are three tribes that we can point at who did not receive an inheritance, a tribal allotment in the land, in the normal sense of the word. Now, each one had their own reasons, but they can certainly be pulled together if we are seeing a unified prior cause. Reuven does not enter the land at all. They settle on the east side. Again, that's their decision. But maybe there's something behind that decision. And they're accompanied by Gad, it is true as well. But Reuven, we see, does not have a natural, normal inheritance in the land, does not end up receiving one. Levi also does not receive a normal inheritance of the land. And what about Shimon? Shimon does, but what's interesting about Shimon's portion, if we see the way the borders are, it is subsumed entirely within that of Yehuda. It is not as distinct a territory as the others. And thus we find, you put them all together, again, each one with their own immediate cause and different causes. But at the end of the day, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi do not have natural, normal tribal allotments in the land of Israel proper. And it's possible to say, says Meshech Chochma, this too is to be attributed to the fact that they did not experience the difficulties in Mitzrayim to the same degree as the other tribes. And therefore, it was telling in the inheritance on the other side. So we've gone back, tracing a line from the brachos of Yaakov through to their experiences in Egypt and then culminating in their inheritance of the land of Israel. But bearing all this in mind, let us come back to our pasuk, where Moshe and Aaron are told, are commanded to the Jewish people, to Bnei Yisrael, and to Paro to take Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. There is an interesting comment of the Yerushalmi in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, which says that at this juncture, the Jewish people were given the mitzvah of releasing slaves, Shiluach Avodim. Kan nitzdavu al shiluach avodim. What does that mean? Many Mefarshim understand that what the Yerushalmi means to say is that although it's not relevant yet because they're all avodim, but just at the brink of being released and set free themselves, they're already given the mitzvah that it should find a receptive ear, that in time when you will yourselves have avodim, be amenable to letting them go when the time comes. It was a time when they could resonate with this mitzvah, even if it wasn't practical anytime soon. That is the common notion among the Mefarshim. But Meshmer Chochma suggests putting all the above together. And it's a striking comment. But when the Yerushalmi says that they were commanded concerning releasing slaves, it's now. Because if these three tribes Nohagu Srora, they had a privileged status, it is possible that they also had as servants other Jews. That's part of the Srora. And therefore, the command to let servants go was of immediate relevance for these three tribes. Which means, as strange as it sounds, that at this moment, when we're about to initiate the process of releasing the Jewish people from servitude, it is not only Paro who has to do that, it's also the Jewish people from their own servants. And that is the literal meaning of the pasuk where Hashem commands Moshe and Aaron to the Jewish people. First to the Jewish people, and then to Paro, with exactly the same goal in mind. Lehotzi es bnei Yisrael mimitzrayim, to release the Jewish people from servitude, and the Jewish people need to do it first. And then Paro is told to do that. A stunning perush. And in fact, says Meshech Chochma, that is why the perik ends, or more correctly, towards the end, after we've gone the run of Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and then the families of Levi down to Moshe and Aaron. Pasuk Kaf Vav, at the end of Perik Vav, reads, Hu Aaron and Moshe, Asher Amar Hashem Lahem. This is the same Aaron and Moshe that Hashem said, Hotzias Bnei Yisrael Mi'eretz Mitzrayim, take the Jewish people out of the land of Egypt, Al Tziv Osam, by their hosts, that is to say, in their groups. What is the full meaning of this expression, Al Tziv Osam, in their groups? Tzava is a defined group. Every tribe is a defined group. What does that mean? It means you cannot have people from one tribe who are together with another tribe as their servants. They cannot be subsumed within some other group. Al Tzivo Sam means every group is distinct. If you have people from other tribes, maybe until now they had been servants of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi to whatever degree or in whatever capacity they were, but everyone is set free now, beginning with the Jewish people themselves. Kan nitzdavu al shiluach avodim, which means that all the tribes leave intact, al tzivo sam, as the pasuk concludes. So these are very challenging comments of Meshech Chochma. Again, it begins and ends with the pasuk, even as we move backwards and forwards in the interim. A very major topic within the parsha of Va'era is the well-known notion of the hardening of Paro's heart. This is something which is described at the beginning of Perek Zion in our parsha. Hashem says, I will harden Paro's heart. Va'ani akshe eslev Paro. It's already been described or mentioned in Parsha Shemos, Perek Dalet Pasuk Kaf Aleph. But in the end, what happens is Paro's heart is hardened, seemingly leaving him with no ability to accede to the demands of Moshe in Hashem's name until the time is right. And there are two basic questions that we need to ask. They're not the same question. They're related to each other, but they are two distinct questions. The first relates to the concept of Bechira, of free will. In other words, we have a basic premise that a person is always able to choose, for better or for worse, good or bad. How does this notion of Hashem hardening Paro's heart fit together with that principle? If that is a principle across the board, this would seem to be in conflict. That principle says a person can always choose. This idea says that Paro was not able to choose. So how did the two go together? How does it find its place within that idea? And the second question is, even if we're able to understand that Hashem did not allow Paro to choose to do the right thing and to let the Jewish people go, but what we do find is that every time he says no, he's punished. That's a separate question. The first is more of a free will question in terms of the possibilities. The second is a divine justice question. In other words, granted, let's say that it is the case that his ability to choose to do the right thing is suspended, but how then can the result of that be the punishments of the plagues? Punishment comes for a crime. Crime denotes that a person could have done otherwise. That is the second question. And we will see, I mean, these are major discussions. There's a whole literature, of course, about them. But we will take a look at two classic approaches, the Rambam and the Ramban. And there are others as well. Of course, we've discussed at other times, the Sforno and the Maaseh Hashem, etc. But we will focus on Rambam and Ramban. So approach number one, which is the Rambam, and the Rambam discusses this in two places. Number one, in Hilchos Tshuva, in the sixth chapter, and number two, in the Shmona Prakim. The Shmona Prakim are the Rambam's eight introductory chapters to his commentary on Pirkei Avos, where he also discusses major ideas of Jewish thought, and in the eighth of those eight chapters, he also discusses the concept of hardening Paro's heart. And Rambam says as follows. There is a general rule, and the general rule is that a person can always choose right or wrong. And part of what that means is that a person will always be able to choose to do tshuva at any time. That's the right decision at any stage if a person has done the wrong thing. That's the rule, and around that is built the entire Hilchos Tshuva. However, says Rambam, there are certain crimes which are so severe, and every crime deserves a punishment, and the punishment may be something in this world, something in the next world, or both. Sometimes the punishment for the crime is itself the idea that this person should not be able to do tshuva. That's the punishment. As surely as a punisher can be to withhold something physically from a person, certain capacities or properties, so too, if the sin or sins is or are severe enough, then the punishment itself is to not allow that person to be able to do tshuva. Says Rambam, an example of that, the first of a number of examples, it should be noted, is Paro. And what is happening here is that Paro's sins were so severe, his crimes against the Jewish people were so severe, that his punishment is that he's not able to do tshuva. He cites a pasuk in Yeshaya. It's the Haftarah actually for Parashas Yisro. Hashmein lev ha'am hazeh. Ve'inav hashavos. Blind the eyes of the people, make their ears deaf, lest they do tshuva. In other words, the Navi is describing a situation where steps are taken to stop people from being able to do tshuva. Paro is the first classic example of this idea. But there are others also. The truth is that there's another personality. He's less discussed than Paro. But the Torah explicitly says that also that Hashem had hardened his heart, or more accurately, hardened his spirit, and that's Sichon. Sichon Melech Ha'er-Mori, all the way later on in Parshas Chukas, Hashem hardens his heart. It's the same idea. But it's not only these two people. Rambam, among his other examples, are many of the Jewish people at the time of Eliyahu HaNavi, who had gone the way of Baal worship to such a degree that they were part or subject to this punishment that they weren't able to do tshuva. Now, what needs to be emphasized, and the Rambam does emphasize, it's important to make this point clear. The punishment of the 10 plagues was not a punishment for Paro refusing at this stage to let the Jewish people go. The punishment was for all of the decades of persecution that had preceded this. That's important to establish. In other words, as much as we read the parshas, Moshe says, so says Hashem, let them go, and if you don't, you'll get this plague. But we shouldn't think that the plague is a punishment for refusing to let them go. That's the trigger for the plague. But the cause of the plague, it's punishment for all the persecution that took place all those years leading up to this. This is now the time of retribution. This is no longer the time of the crime. And that's important to emphasize, because according to the Rambam, at this stage, Paro doesn't have the ability to say yes. If he doesn't have the ability to say yes, you can't punish him for saying no. But this says Rambam, but Hashem isn't punishing him for saying no. The punishment doesn't come as a result of the crime of refusing to let the Jewish people go. It's a punishment for the crime of all the persecution, when Paro did have the ability to choose, and he chose wrong. So from the moment that Moshe comes to Paro, really, our entire parsha, the entire duration of the 10 plagues, Paro's free will has already been suspended, and that's part of his punishment, that he should die a rasha. Now, Mefarshim point out, and this is discussed by Rav Yosef Cohen, grandson of Rav Pesach Frank, in his Sefer HaTshuva. It's a three-volume work on the Rambam Hilchos Tshuva, and he and others point out that we normally say that Paro, within understanding Rambam's position, Paro had reached a point where he was no longer able to do tshuva. He'd passed the point of being able to do tshuva. But we should appreciate that itself could take one of two forms. If you do not wish for him to do tshuva, so then his inability to do tshuva could take one of two forms. A, which is the form that it took, Hashem didn't allow him to want to do tshuva. Meaning the entire initiative on Paro's part was stalled, or was disabled at the root. That's the way that it happened. But one could envisage another way of not allowing him to do tshuva. Namely, for him to do tshuva and it's not accepted. If we understand Paro, his punishment is that he's not able to do tshuva. So let him try and it will be rejected. It's important to consider this alternative, because the alternative doesn't interfere with his free will. He can decide that he wants to do tshuva, but it's too late. I mean, the moral of the story is it's too late. So why is that expressed by interfering with his free will, not enabling him to want to do tshuva, which is surely the path of greater resistance, involving as it does, conflicting with the idea of free will, leave free will alone, let him choose what he wants, and in the event that he wants to do tshuva, say no. I mean, the result is the same. No tshuva for Paro. So why is the more internal root path taken of not even allowing him to want to do tshuva? It's a very interesting question. I mean, the net result is no. Whether it's no that he doesn't do it or no that it's not accepted, the net result is no. But apparently, the net result is not the same. In other words, had Hashem left Paro alone, Bechira-wise, and had Paro chosen to do tshuva, apparently, either the answer would not have been no, because if Paro does tshuva, or if anyone does tshuva, the answer will have to be a yes of sorts. Again, anything's possible. Hashem is in charge of everything. But within the way that tshuva has been set up, if a person does tshuva, the answer will be yes, whether it's a full yes, partial yes. There is no such thing as a person doing tshuva, and the answer is an absolute no. And if that's true, and you don't want Paro to benefit from tshuva, there's only one way possible, and that is to stop him doing tshuva in the first place. Because if he chooses to do tshuva, it will make a difference. It will have to make a difference. And perhaps one might say a little bit more nuanced in this regard. When a person does tshuva, it relates to two things. After all, how does a person become a rasha? Presumably by doing things that rishayim do. If they do enough sins, and then the net result is that they're a rasha, which means that there will be comeuppance for their wrong actions, and there's also their status as a wicked person. Tshuva ultimately seeks to deal with both of those things. Number one, to change the status of a person from a rasha to a tzaddik, and also to absolve them of the consequences of the punishments for their misdeeds. That's kapara. These are two separate things. They're obviously related, but they're two separate things. The status of a person and whether or not they'll be punished for their misdeeds. You could envisage one without the other. It could be that a person has done tshuva in the sense that they're now a tzaddik. They may still need to do other things to get kapara. There's a famous Mishnah in Maseches Kiddushin, where a person betroths a woman or halachically marries her through Kiddushin, on condition that he's a tzaddik. There's a proposal. On condition that he's a tzaddik, says the Gemara, even if he's known to be a rasha, we still consider that the kiddushin may have gone through. Because maybe he did tshuva, maybe he thought about tshuva in that moment. So, since when is just thinking about tshuva take care of everything? After all, aren't there other things? Isn't there vidui? Aren't there other things a person needs to go through? He had a thought to do tshuva. But Mefarshim say, we see from here that his status as a tzaddik can change just by thinking that he wants to do tshuva. To get kapara for his misdeeds may take longer. He didn't betroth her on condition that he has no averus. And maybe he still does. He's a tzaddik with averus. His status has changed. He'll now need to go through the process of getting kapara. And to put that idea, which again is a major discussion about tshuva, to put it back into our situation, that's really what the Rambam is saying. That had Paro been left to decide, Paro's punishment is that he should die a rasha. Had he decided to do tshuva, he would not be a rasha anymore. He might still be punished, because maybe his averus didn't go away, but he wouldn't be a rasha. So if a person says, I want to do tshuva, you can't say no. You can say no to kapara. And therefore, if the goal is not only that he should be punished, but also that he should never shed his status as rasha, the only way to ensure that is by making sure that he never wants to do tshuva. And if that involves interfering with his bechira and suspending his ability to want to do tshuva, so be it. And that's the way that it worked. It is interesting to note that Hashem tells Moshe from the outset that he will harden Paro's heart. And as far as the Rambam is concerned, that is completely in order, because that was already true from the outset. Even before Hashem sends Moshe to Paro for the very first time, he already says he will harden Paro's heart. According to the Rambam, yes, because that's already happening. Already from the time that Moshe goes to him, Paro is at this stage already not able to choose to let the Jewish people go. The only thing that remains, or that for us to discuss this evening with regards to Rambam, is what then is Moshe going to him again and again, let my people go, and if you don't, these are the consequences. I mean, this is impossible for Paro at this stage to say yes. So why is Moshe warning him on all these separate occasions? If there's no way that it can make a difference, you know he's going to say no. So to this, Rambam says, on the contrary, it's to demonstrate this point. It's to publicize this point that here is Paro. No one in their right mind would continue to say no. Here is Paro being warned repeatedly, and look at him. He has no choice but to say no. It's to demonstrate this very idea that this was his punishment, the inability to say yes. So this is, in broad strokes, the approach of the Rambam, again in Hilchos Tshuva and the Shmona Prakim. Many, many pages have been written in elaboration, but this is, in brief, Rambam's position. The whole thing was a punishment. Both the no and the punishments were all part of the punishment for the crimes of persecuting the Jewish people. And that's why the midah keneged midah, the measure for measure that the Medrash always identified, why were they stricken with blood and with frogs, it always is traced back to their persecution of the Jewish people. It's never traced back to Paro saying no, because the crime is the persecution that took place before all of this. The second approach is the Ramban. The Ramban himself brings two approaches. He starts with the Rambam's approach, and then the second approach is based on a Medrash. Medrash Mos Rabba, Resh Lakish. And the Medrash says that if you note, you will see that the Torah never actually describes Hashem hardening Paro's heart until the sixth Makkah. For the early Makkos, the reference is always to Paro hardening his own heart. Vayechezak li Paro, vayechbed Paro es libo. And the Medrash notes this and explains that for the first five times, Paro hardened his own heart. As a result of that, for the last five, Hashem hardened Paro's heart. Now, what does this mean? I think on a very simple level, we'd be inclined to look upon this as a kind of a, like an internal measure for measure, five for five, which really does make it sound like the punishment for him hardening his heart the first five times is that Hashem hardened his heart for the second. So it really does sound like it's a response. The wrongdoing is within him saying no the first five times. But actually, a deeper look into the words, a closer look at the words of the Ramban, reveal that he does not understand it that way. It's not merely he does five, so then in response Hashem does five. It's something else. And worthwhile noting, because for Ramban, it's going to emerge as somewhat more nuanced. What happened in those first five Makkos? Basically, Paro says he's not going to let the Jewish people go. He wavers a bit during the Makkah, but afterwards he's back to his old ways, and no is no. And basically, what he establishes during those first five plagues is that he does not wish to accede to Hashem's will. He's not interested. Hashem demands that the Jewish people be let go, and Paro doesn't want, and he doesn't care. Once that's true, that remains. That remains Paro's principal position. He's not interested in obeying Hashem's command to let the Jewish people go. And he does not regret anything he did, and he is not having a change of heart. Now, it's also true, says Ramban, as the plagues continue, life will get more and more difficult for Paro. The last five are going to be much worse than the first five. That may well be. And that could lead to the following situation. Paro may end up saying yes at some point in the second set of five Makos. But not because he has a change of heart. It's just that he is progressively being more and more weakened by the plagues until he just doesn't have the strength to say no anymore. That's not a change of heart. That's a weakening of constitution. And that's not called tshuva. That's just called disintegration. And if that will be the reason why Paro might say yes, he's already established clearly. Plagues will not make him change his position on things. They'll not make him change his view of anything that he's done or about the Jewish people. And even the six won't change his mind. They'll just weaken him. The weakening, says Ramban, is not reason enough for him not to receive the punishment due for his crimes. Were he to actually do tshuva properly, as if to say, I really did the wrong thing, and I'm prepared to confess my sins, and I'm sorry that I did it, and I'm ready to obey Hashem, even when the plague clears. If he were to say that, then that would be accepted even in the second set of five plagues. But if all he's saying is, it's enough, and I can't take it anymore, that's not reason enough to allow him to evade punishment. And to that end, Hashem strengthened his heart, that is to say, to give him further resolve to endure the Makos. The implications of what the Ramban is saying, I believe, is that Hashem never interfered with Paro's Bechira. Not in the first five, where Paro hardened his own heart, however that worked. And also not in the second five. In the second five, Hashem gave him strengthened his constitution. But the ability for Paro to do tshuva remained even in the second set of Makos. But it's something that he never took, and thus he ended up enduring all of the 10 Makos. So these are the two approaches of Rambam and Ramban to the very major question in our parasha, which has implications, of course, for these ideas beyond that. But at least to have taken some comprehensive look at these two approaches. There's others, as we said, Ikrim and the Akeda and the Sforno and Ibn Ezra. Mitz Hashem will leave for a different time. I'd like to move from that discussion actually to discuss the Makkah where, according to the Medrash, it was the turning point. Makkah number six, which is Shechin. I think Shechin somehow is able to avoid discussion. We often focus on either on the earlier ones or the later ones. Shechin somehow is in the middle, not neither here nor there. Let us take a look and try and do justice to the psukim here. So Shechin is in Perek Tes. It's five psukim, Ches to Yud Beis. But as we'll see, there are some unusual aspects. Unique aspects among the plagues. So Perek Tes, Pasuk Ches. Vayomer Hashem Moshe vel Aaron. Hashem says to Moshe and Aaron, Kechu lechem melochof nechem, take handsful of piach kivshan, of soot, from a furnace, like ash, dust. Uzuakom Moshe ha-shamayma le'enei Paro. And Moshe shall throw it heavenwards in front of Paro. And then what will happen? Vayala avak al kol eretz Mitzrayim. It will then be dust over all of Egypt. And it will become Shechin boils over man and beast. Pasuk Yud, and that's what happened. They took the soot, handfuls, and they stood before Paro. Vayizroko, so Moshe Shemaima, Moshe threw it heavenwards. And indeed, it then affected man and beast. Rashi discusses how there were beasts left. This is after Dever, where it sounds like they all died. Apparently some survived. Rashi talks about that. But they survived and then received this plague together with their owners. Yud Aleph, v'lo yochlu achar tumim la'amod lefnei Moshe mipnei ha-shechin. The sorcerers were not able to stand before Moshe on account of the shechin, the boils, ki haya shechin b'chartumim u'b'chol Mitzrayim, because it was in the sorcerers and all of Egypt. Final pasuk, vayichazek Hashem eslei Paro, which, as we noted, this is the first time that we have a reference to Hashem strengthening Paro's heart. V'lo shama lehem kashedi b'Hashem Moshe. He didn't listen to them, just as Hashem told Moshe. This is makashchin, the plague of boils. And some distinct characteristics about this makkah. So firstly, as we mentioned, it's the first time we hear Hashem hardening Paro's heart. That's a first. We also have a last. This is the last plague out of the 10 that the Khartoumim, Paro's sorcerers, are mentioned. Interestingly, they were quite prominent in the first three plagues, whether they succeeded or failed. For blood and for frogs, they were somehow able to replicate the plague. For lice, not so. That's 1, 2, and 3 they're mentioned. In plagues 4 and 5, Arov and Dever, they kind of go into hiatus a little bit. We don't hear from them. But we hear from them here, and that's the last we hear from them. They're not able to stand before Moshe. That itself is an interesting discussion. What does it mean they can't stand before Moshe? Can they stand before someone else? If they can stand, they can stand. What does it mean they can't stand before Moshe? The Ramban explains, Al-Derech HaPshat, that it means they were physically able to stand, but they were just absolutely so debunked and disgraced by this whole experience, they could not stand before Moshe. They were just shame and disgrace. After all of their boasting and of their abilities, that's what it means they couldn't stand before Moshe. The act that brings about the plague is also somewhat more involved than usual, meaning there are other plagues which have an act that bring them about, but they're just basically one linear thing. Hit the Nile, strike the earth, raise up your hand, heavenwards, something like that. Here, it is altogether more involved. It's got the soot, and then it's turned upwards, and then it becomes something else, and it's also interesting that this is the only plague where the trigger act was a collaborative effort on the part of Moshe and Aaron. They both take the soot. That's how it all begins. Moshe throws it upwards, but they're both involved, and that's also unique. In fact, this needs to be developed more because the uniqueness doesn't end there. The Medrash notes, and it's very interesting to look at things in this way. Some makos are performed by Aaron, the first three. And we know Rashi cites the Medrash, Moshe couldn't be involved, it's the water, it's the dirt. So the first three were done by Aaron. Three makos have trigger acts by Moshe. Okay, hail, and the locusts and the darkness are all done by Moshe. He stretches out his hand heavenwards. Three of them do not have any trigger act, initiating act, on any human being's part. They just happen. Hashem brings them directly, so to speak. That's Arov, right, the wild animals, Dever, the plague, and Bechoros, the smiting of the firstborn. There is no initiative act at all on human part. And the Medrash explains that this is bedafka. Hashem deliberately divided the plagues into three. It quotes a marshal of a general. He goes to defeat an enemy and he has two trusted lieutenants and he wishes to give them credit. And this is what happened in Mitzrayim. Moshe and Aaron are Hashem's deputies, his lieutenants. And therefore, when the time comes to dispense divine justice, Hashem says, we'll split it three ways. It's bedafka. I'll take three. Moshe will do three. And Aaron will do three. Of course, in the end, it doesn't happen if Hashem doesn't let it happen. But it is delegated in that way. So it's split three ways. There's just one thing. There's 10 plagues. You can't split 10 three ways. You can split 9 three ways. But what about the 10th plague? Says the Medrash, the 10th plague was also split three ways because it was a collaborative involvement of Moshe, Aaron, and Hashem. It was an absolute division into three. Now, Moshe and Aaron's involvement that we've seen in the Pasuk. They both take the ashes and then Moshe throws them up. What is Hashem's involvement, so to speak, in this plague more than any other plagues? He's always the one ultimately who does the plague. But why is this considered something that all three of them do? The Alshech HaKadosh has an incredible explanation and analysis of this plague. And he begins by talking about Moshe and Aaron. You'll note, and as we said, three of the plagues are triggered by Aaron, three of the plagues are triggered by Moshe. You'll note that the ones that are triggered by Aaron have something in common, and likewise for Moshe. We have the notion of the four basic elements, earth and water, fire and air, or wind. And we see that these are divided. Control, executive control over these elements are divided between Moshe and Aaron. Moshe is relatively on a higher level than Aaron, and therefore Aaron, the elements that he is given control over, punitive control, are earth and water. And that is why the plagues, the entities that he interacts with are the first three plagues, are earth and water. Strikes the Nile, the dust is turned into lice. Moshe is delegated control over the higher two elements, which is fire and wind. And that means that many of the plagues of Moshe, or all of them, in fact, involve the wind or the air. Locusts are brought through the wind. The hail, it comes down, right, from above, through the sky. And even Choshech, and Choshech is really the air turning dark, especially according to the Medrash, that it was a thick darkness, which means the consistency of the air itself thickened. That's the control given to Moshe over wind and also fire. The hail had fire inside, even though the hail is water, could be that came from the higher waters. This is the general division. Aaron gets the lower two elements of earth and water, Moshe the higher two of fire and air. And then Hashem deals with all of the entities that are higher than that. Life forms directly. Arov are wild animals that attack wild animals, that attack people. Dever again attacks the animals, and Bechoros kills the firstborn. What about our Maka? If that's the general division of 3, 3, and 3, so now we come to Makas Shechin. And we will see why Moshe and Aaron collaborate together, because it involves all of the elements, both the ones that Aaron is put in charge in, and so too Moshe. It starts with the element of earth, of the ash, the soot, which is like earth. So then Aaron and Moshe take that. Moshe throws it upwards. And this is now very interesting. In addition to the fact that of course, Moshe will be involved because these are boils, meaning there's heat involved, and that's the element of fire. But beyond that, the element of wind is also very significant. As the Medrash points out, the way the Pasuk describes it, these handfuls of ashes were thrown upwards and then they dispersed over all of Egypt. That cannot be done naturally because the wind will disperse them within just a few feet of being thrown up. Which means, in order to allow them to be thrown up and then dispersed over the dust dispersed over all of Egypt, they have to have been given passage, so to speak, almost like an air passage, an air duct within the air allowing them to be propelled upwards, kept intact until they're as high as they need to go, and then the wind will disperse them over all of Egypt. But that's control over air. Because if air was left to its normal running, this ash would not have gotten very high. So to be propelled upwards intact and then dispersed, that's air. And of course, as we said, the element of fire involves Moshe because the boils themselves, they were boiling hot. And says the Al-Sheikh, an unbelievable idea. Once we appreciate that Moshe has been given control over the element of fire within this plague, this will give us a new appreciation of that pasuk which says that the Chartumim were not able to stand before Moshe. And we ask the question, if you can stand, you should stand before him. And if you can't, you can't stand before anyone. We noted Ramban. Ramban says they were out of shame. They weren't, not physically they couldn't stand. Out of shame they weren't able to stand before Moshe in all of their disgrace. But the Al-Sheikh says no. Before anyone else they could stand. They had boils, but they weren't manageable. They were but yet able to stand. But they couldn't stand before Moshe. Because Moshe was the one who was responsible, the agency through which the element of fire became part of the Makkah. The closer they got to Moshe, there was an induction of heat. The closer they got to the agent through which the fire was injected into the plague, the more their own boils heated up and they were unable to stand. So they had to keep a distance from Moshe. It's an incredible way of looking at the pasuk. So this now is the role of Aaron. And of course, the only other element that's missing is water, but there was water also in the boils without going into all of those difficult details. But that the Gemara in Baba Kama says that it was moisture and heat. So that's Moshe's role, that's Aaron's role. All elements have been accounted for. What about HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role beyond overseeing all of this? The Medrash says that when Moshe threw the ashes up and they were thrown hashamayma, they reached all the way to the Kisei HaKavod, which is very high. And the Kisei HaKavod is not a place. Seemingly much higher than it needed to be dispersed over Egypt. So what does it mean? So the Al-Sheikh refers us to a Medrash elsewhere in Shir HaShirim. It's a well-known idea. And that is, every nation has a spiritual overseer. And when the time for that, the downfall of that nation comes, it begins with the downfall of their overseer. Every nation has a sar. And in the words of the Medrash, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Nifra Me'uma, Hashem does not exact retribution from a nation, Lifnation Nifra Misara, until he first exacts retribution and knocks down the spiritual overseer. It cites a pasuk in Yeshaya, Yifkod Hashem al Tzava Marom Bamarom. Hashem will first visit on the host of on high, Val Tzava HaAdama BaAdama, and then subsequently on the nation down here. At a certain point, therefore, the Tsar of Mitzrayim needed to be taken down. That point, according to the Medrash, is this Makkah. And where do we see it? Go back to Pasuk Yud Aleph, which states, V'lo yachlu achartumim la'amod lefnei Moshe mipnei ha-shechin. The chartumim, the sorcerers, were not able to stand before Moshe, as we discussed, because of the, on account of the boils. Ki haya ha-shechin b'chartumim u'b'chol Mitzrayim. Because the plague of boils was b'chartumim and all Mitzrayim. There are two references to the Chartumim here. However, says the Medrash, they're not the same. The first time the word Chartumim is written with a Yud at the end. Mem Yud Mem HaChartumim. And Chartumim means the sorcerers. The second time there's no Yud. It's still pronounced B'Chartumim. But the Medrash says it can be read as B'Chartumam. With their own overseer. Khartoumam, there. The mem now is the suffix denoting third person plural. The reason why the Khartoumim were not able even to stand before Moshe is because Khartoumam, their own hallowed source of spiritual power, was also affected by the plague. That was Hashem's role within the Makkah of Shechin. That's why the dirt began and the ash began by being thrown up. It's not thrown directly across Egypt just to land. It is thrown up. It goes all the way up, as the Medrash describes, to the Kisei HaKovod, because comeuppance and retribution is first to be exacted on high. Al tzava marom ba marom, and that sorrow shall Mitzrayim. Khartoumam. Once that's true, it then descends, is scattered over Egypt, and takes the form of this plague. That is the three-part collaboration, so to speak, in this most unusual and unique plague now. Aaron's contribution, Moshe's, and Hashem's itself. It's very interesting, in terms of our earlier discussion, to see that the sixth plague, according to the Medrash, brings in two parallel developments. One of them, as we said, the spiritual overseer of Egypt begins to be dismantled. He is toppled at that stage. That is an external spiritual development. At the very same time, the Medrash noted, this is the first time we see the Pasuk saying that Hashem hardened Paro's heart. It's amazing to see the parallel. While above Egypt, Hashem is already dismantling the spiritual infrastructure, and within Paro, there is a similar dismantling as the Medrash denotes, and that really is now a turning point as we move from the first five Makkahs into to the second five. And it's only downhill from there, as far as Mitzrayim is concerned, uphill for us. So these are some of the classic, again, guided by the Al Sheikh HaKadosh, the attention to detail in the Pasuk, the words, every letter even, and so on, against the backdrop of the Midrashim, certainly gives us a greater appreciation for this plague. And Ki Meitzei Seinu Me'eretz Mitzrayim Ya'arenu Nuflos. We read the parshas of Yetzias Mitzrayim. They should be a source of chizuk. They should be a source of further geula for us. And just as our enemies were smitten with everything they deserved at that time, so too by Amim Ahem, Basman Azeh Mitz Hashem, we should see that happen and be witness to the geula. Shalem v'tshuas olamin b'meheira b'yamein amin.